Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey folks, I'm Alex Dowd.
And I'm Katie Rife.
Licorice Pizza, the brand new film from Paul Thomas Anderson, hits theaters at the end of November. To celebrate the occasion, we're spending the next 4 weeks discussing the other movies by this revered master of American cinema. In the first installment of our four-part series, we revisit the films that kicked off this one-of-a-kind career. Anderson's low-key casino noir debut, Hard Eight, and his sprawling porn industry epic, Boogie Nights.
Welcome to Film Club.
Okay, folks, welcome again to a new episode of Film Club. Thank you for joining us today and listening. We are now in it's November, which means that the year is we're in the final stretch of 2021.
And we're in traditional best films of the year season for film critics. You go from October, where it's all about horror movies, to prestige movies, I guess you could call them, major works by big name filmmakers, which occasionally is a horror movie, but you, no, most of them aren't.
True. I feel like we spend almost all of October focused on horror stuff. We have this horrors week that we do at the AV Club, and we just end up immersed in that. And then, like, the minute that the calendar rolls over to November 1, I don't know about you, but my mind just goes to, oh, shit, we only have a few more weeks. I have to start catching up with things I haven't seen this year.
Yeah, you know? For sure. And all the screenings start rolling out and like that. And, yeah, it's an exciting time, I think.
Yep. So one of the films that remains for both of us to see, one of the films that has not, as far as I know, hasn't really screened for anyone. I think maybe there's been a couple of maybe Los Angeles,
not
very
publicly.
small screenings of this. But that would, of course, be the new film by Paul Thomas Anderson, Licorice Pizza.
Well, they're actually doing kind of a trailer rollout for Licorice Pizza, where first they were showing trailers at American Cinematheque in L.A., and then a few theaters have gotten them since then, including Music Box here in Chicago, which has been a good friend to Paul Thomas Anderson over the years, and vice versa.
Yep. The trailer is also available online at this point as well.
But at first, you could only see it in 35.
Right.
One of those fun rollouts.
Yep. Anderson is one of the few, I feel like, the few American filmmakers who has the clout to kind of set some of his terms in terms of how a film is going to be seen. And he just although I'm not sure that's particularly attached to the money that his movies make, because I think a lot of the time they don't necessarily make a ton of money.
Yeah, this is something we were talking about off mic in a different context before we started recording. But yeah, like there really are only a handful of filmmakers who seem to be able to make demands in terms of like, well, I only want this shown in 35, or I only want this shown here, or we have to roll it out like this. And, you know, in terms of like big studio guys, it's really like in my mind, it's like Nolan, Tarantino, and Anderson are the ones who can make demands.
Pretty much. Yep. And Anderson sort of straddles that line between indie and studio, because studios do often release his films. But he also is kind of operating in with the resources of an indie filmmaker.
Yeah, that's true. He really does straddle the line, and he kind of has his whole career, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at his budgets, Anderson is pretty much in the 15 to 40 million range.
The mid budget movie that people say no one makes anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's one of the few working filmmakers who still is operating in that zone, sort of an endangered species at this point. I mean, Hollywood has mostly given up on the mid budget movie, and I guess by some relatively speaking, you could still call a movie like There Will Be Blood, which cost $25 million, a low budget movie.
Yeah, like when the idea of a low budget movie, generally in my mind, if it costs less than $10 million,
yeah,
that's like an indie, a low budget movie. The amounts of money that are involved in filmmaking are pretty mind boggling to the average person.
Know.
You know, like, oh, it's low budget. It only costs $5
million. Exactly. I'll never see that money in my life. I'll never see that much money in my life, you know? So Anderson's been sort of operating in that mode for a while now. Licorice Pizza is his new film, which is coming out this November. I would say Anderson is also one of the few American filmmakers who every new movie by them is an event.
Mm-hmm.
When they release a new film, it's a big deal.
Yeah, and the trailer's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that it's a big event that isn't a tentpole. It has nothing to do with IP. It has nothing to do with franchises. And he's never made much of anything like that, and I doubt he ever will.
Right. No, it's very hard for me to imagine Paul Thomas Anderson getting pulled into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, I just don't know if that's going to happen.
I mean, just based on what we know, I think, about him as an artist and about his personality and his interests, it just, you know, Anderson has carved out, I mean, you kind of have to ask why.
Mm.
I mean, he could make more money than he's making, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I have to imagine Paul Thomas Anderson is not struggling as an artist. He's
not
a starving artist.
I'm sure he's doing fine.
His movies, again, don't tend to make a ton of money, but they make enough.
Yeah, and he's married to a successful comedian, so I'm sure they're doing just fine.
Right. For those who don't know, Paul Thomas Anderson is married to Maya Rudolph.
You know that question of, like, is there a couple that you would be truly upset if they broke up? I would be genuinely sad if I found out those two broke up.
Well, they've been together for a while, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So Licorice Pizza, we don't know a ton about at this point, but beyond what the trailers have shown us. I remember when it was first announced, there was this notion that it was going to be kind of his American Graffiti or his Dazed and Confused. It is set in the San Fernando Valley of the 1970s. AKA more or less the same location as Boogie Nights and also Inherent Vice, and also pretty much where Paul Thomas Anderson grew up, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep. So I think there may be some rumblings that this one might be might be semi-autobiographical.
Right. It is kind of getting into Linklater territory, this newest one. And Paul Thomas Anderson, there's so many different styles at play in his stuff. You know, you kind of got the combination of the low-key hangout movie combined with the really, like, bravura camera work Yeah, there's just a lot of different director styles kind of combined into his. He's really – sometimes he's a little bit of a show-off, like we'll talk about with Boogie Nights, but he's
His early films especially, I think.
Yeah.
I think if there's an arc to Anderson's career, it has been shedding some of the sort of hotshot qualities that defined his work early on.
Well, he was a boy wonder, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
so.
He was he came up in the 90s, obviously, and he came up with a group of filmmakers who I don't think they've ever really been given a name, but just, 90s filmmakers who came up during the indie boom.
Mm-hmm.
And Anderson, I think one of the reasons that Anderson is revered as he is today is that he he never went out of fashion, and I think he kept evolving as an artist.
Yes.
Anderson is not somebody who flamed out, who now looks like, you don't look at his work and think he's some relic of the 90s.
Right. It doesn't seem dated, his work now. Yeah.
But a big part of that, I think, is that Anderson, like a lot of artists, Anderson started out emulating a lot of the sort of giants, the giant influences on his work.
Absolutely.
He started sort of doing his take on Robert Altman, on Martin Scorsese, on Jonathan Demme. And eventually, as often happens with great artists, the qualities that felt imitative sort of fell away and Anderson became himself.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that has a lot to do with Anderson as a film school guy. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the traditional, beginning with the 70s where you had the film school brats of the 70s. And then in the 90s, it was a more varied field. Not everybody came out of film schools from that 90s wave, but they were similar to the 70s wave in the sense that they were very much all about digesting and recontextualizing their influences. They're like filmmakers who are obsessed with movies.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I think we'll talk a little bit today about some of the parallels between Anderson's early work and Quentin Tarantino's, because I think there's actually quite a lot of them that go beyond merely some shared cast members, you know? What we're going to be doing over the next month is we're going to be talking about all of the films of Paul Thomas Anderson leading up to the release of Licorice Pizza.
And this is super exciting.
Yeah.
I really like Paul Thomas Anderson.
I love most of his work. Yeah. In fact, revisiting these two films, the only one that I felt kind of shaky on was Hard Eight. Mm-hmm. And I do think that. Well, I don't want to tease it too much, I guess. I would say that I think Hard Eight is probably his weakest film.
What's his first?
But it's his first, you know? Yeah, it's very much a debut.
Yeah.
I think that everything he's done since has been interesting in some respect. Interesting to great, you mm-hmm, know?
Mm-hmm.
We'll be doing it as a four-part series. If you last summer, obviously, we did something similar with the work of Christopher Nolan. Anderson has a slightly smaller filmography, but we'll be doing it again. It'll be a four week series.
Mm-hmm.
So this week we're talking about Hard Eight and Boogie Nights, his mm-hmm. first two films. And we will be talking about two films a week until the end of November when at that point we will hopefully have seen Licorice Pizza.
Yeah. Not strictly chronological. We're mixing it up just a little bit. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Anderson's music video work also, because that's thing about him as a filmmaker is he makes a lot of music videos.
He does, which is interesting because I feel like a lot of filmmakers of that period of the 90s, some of them, I mean, somebody like David Fincher,
Fincher came up on music videos.
Came from music videos into film, whereas mm-hmm. I feel like Anderson made short films and then eventually moved into making music
videos. Yeah, that's true. That's true. And he still makes them to this day, like Haim, the band. He does all their videos, and it's an event when one of those comes out too.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. I will say that there's one feature we will not be touching upon, which is his documentary that he made a few years ago, Junun, which is about Johnny Greenwood going to India to make a film with, mm-hmm. with an artist there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 55 minute film. It's a movie.
In terms of like his larger, I wouldn't call it a major work.
That movie is a doodle.
Yeah.
Having seen and reviewed that movie for the site, I think it would be unusual to devote an entire episode or even half an episode to that film.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're intensely interested in Anderson, I think it's worth seeking out.
It's a completionist kind of
for
thing.
For sure. It definitely is the type of thing that no disrespect to the film, which I do think it's interesting in some ways. I think that movie could very easily be a supplement on a package for mm-hmm. one of his other films, you know.
Yeah, fair.
But today we are talking about Anderson's first two movies, which I love this fact, but these movies were actually through coincidence and through distribution serendipity were actually released in the same year.
Yeah.
In American theaters. They both came out in 1997. Hard Eight obviously a few months before Boogie Nights. It's just really interesting to me. I'm just imagining maybe an average viewer or even a critic who had not been able to see Hard Eight at Cannes, for example,
mm-hmm.
seeing Hard Eight early in the year, 1997, and then going sort of, oh, well, there's some promise in this. I wonder what he'll do with it. And then getting your answer.
And then getting Boogie Nights.
6 months later, you know, because the leap from Hard Eight to Boogie Nights is a significant one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So seeing those both come out in the same year. Pretty remarkable, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's another kind of something that still happens. You still see festival films. Like, well, what year did it play at Cannes? In 96?
Yeah.
Yeah, you still see that sometimes, a movie that, takes sometimes a year or more to make it, abroad.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it's not that unusual even for a filmmaker to have a couple films in the same year. I mean, Ridley Scott, for example, has two this year. I mean,
mm-hmm.
both The Last Duel and House of Gucci, and that they'll ultimately have been released 2 months apart or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think what's really remarkable about this situation is, you know, how quickly Boogie Nights got made. You know, that's the thing. That's the remarkable thing is that, you know, somebody saw Boogie Nights and went, or excuse me, saw Hard Eight and went, absolutely, give this guy money right now.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah,
that's unusual.
Yeah, and $15 million as well. You know,
mm-hmm.
Although in the '90s, again, it was a whole different time for this industry, where people were I think a little bit more willing to fund something like Boogie Nights, even though Boogie Nights there was some fights about content.
And if you want to know more about the context of this, there is a book called Down and Dirty Pictures that chronicles this entire history. So you can kind of get an overview of, you know, the 90s indie boom and how all that worked in terms of the industry.
Yep. The Miramax years, the Sundance
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's all in there. And surely there's some stuff about Anderson in there as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, Anderson's a Sundance guy.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the reason you look at Hard Eight and you're like, you know, how exactly did a filmmaker who had never made a feature before secure this cast? I mean, the cast of the film, Philip Baker Hall, Gwyneth Paltrow, John C. Reilly, Samuel L. Jackson. Big names, although I will say that some of them were very early in their career.
Yeah,
that point.
Not the biggest name at the point when this movie was made and came out was Samuel L. Jackson because
probably.
he was coming off of Pulp Fiction.
Right, right. He had just done Pulp Fiction a couple years earlier, and he had gotten an Oscar nomination out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, Hall is sort of a consummate character actor.
Yeah.
And
Paltrow was pretty new at the time. I mean, she, you know, she's. At least a second generation actor, maybe a third.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, wasn't coming out of nowhere, but she wasn't, you know, she didn't get her Oscar until a couple years later.
Right. She had done Seven at the point, you know, what's in the box? and John C. Reilly had appeared in a couple of semi-significant films.
Chicago Boy.
Yep.
That's our boy.
Making good. Hometown hero.
Yep.
But at that point, most of the people in the cast were sort of up and comers. Nonetheless, still a pretty impressive cast.
Yeah, it just shows like good taste and good instincts to have all these people as they're on the upswing.
Totally.
You know?
Yep. And Anderson at that point, yeah, he did come up through Sundance. I believe he had a couple of short films at Sundance that were very successful and sort of got Hard Eight made through that system.
Mm-hmm.
Revisiting it, I am struck by how many of Anderson's signatures are right there immediately.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. Like, they're even down to the Amy Mann song over
yeah.
the closing credits, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, you have the first thing I noticed, honestly, there's this opening scene where they're in this diner and it has these close-ups and people have spoken a lot about Anderson. Anderson's affinity for the films of Jonathan Demme and his use of close-ups. And you can see that right there in the first film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we mentioned Scorsese before, too. There's a lot of Scorsese style tracking shots and things like that.
Yep.
You know, it's obviously brought to 11 in Boogie Nights, but you definitely
yeah.
see it here.
I mean, yeah, Boogie Nights hits it really hard. You know,
yeah,
you can really see his influence there. You know, but it's also got the father-son stuff, which has been kind of a hallmark of Anderson's work. A periodic hallmark, anyway, of his work ever since, and it's right there in the relationship. For those who haven't seen the film, it's sort of about this mentor disciple relationship between this older man played by Philip Baker Hall, who's this kind of we gradually find out he's kind of he's like a reformed muscle. Basically, he's somebody who used to.
Yeah, semi-reformed. He's just basically like a lifer, an underworld lifer. He's someone who's been around for a long time in the underworld. He's a professional gambler.
Yeah.
I really like this character. I really enjoyed this character because he kind of personifies what the movie is doing in that he's like really low key and he can be kind of sweet. You know, he's genuinely a father figure in the movie, but at the same time, he's very hard boiled. And I think this movie like really kind of it strikes a balance between like stylized and low key hang out and, you know, violent action.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. His character is also it should be noted. He has the same name as Philip Baker Hall's character in Midnight Run, which over the years has inspired people to wonder if this is some kind of sequel, if he's playing the same character. You know, I believe the name is spelled differently, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, that's sort of one of Anderson's many fun sort of references to the movies that have shaped him over the years.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about movies that shape you, there's a lot of like archetype characters in this. You know, and variations on that, too. Like, we spoke about Philip Baker Hall's character kind of being this sort of classic underworld figure, but he has this paternal side that makes him more interesting and more complex than that. But, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow's character is kind of a classic hooker with a heart of gold.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of these characters are kind of archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're getting at is that Anderson finds a way to kind of put an idiosyncratic spin on stuff we've seen.
Yeah.
Thousands of times before.
Right, exactly. And idiosyncratic for sure, but also humanistic. You know, that was what I was impressed by him hitting right out the gate is sort of the balance of all those different styles.
Yeah, I mean, the movie's been called a noir, but it's almost not cynical enough to be a noir.
No, it's kind of sweet.
You know, it's ultimately rather sweet in some ways, you know? I mean, it really does invest in this relationship between the two of them. I realized I never really totally explained what the basic premise of the film is, which is that Philip Baker Hall's character, Sidney, finds this this young man played by John C. Reilly, this kind of young fuck-up. He finds him and he sort of takes him under his wing, shows him.
He's sitting outside of a diner. Like, he's homeless. Yep. He's on his last, he's on the skids.
Yep.
He's run out of options, John C. Reilly's character.
Yep. And then so Sidney kind of takes him under his wing and takes him to Vegas and shows him the ropes, teaches him how to kind of be a gambler and how to get free things from the hotel. Speaking of which, that whole sequence is great. I almost wish there was more of that stuff in the movie, that sort of how to game the system stuff, you know?
I don't have a brain for statistics at all. Like, there's something about gambling, like gambling scams in movies where it's this combination of like sleight of hand and statistics.
Yeah.
And I just like, what? I'm too right brain to understand.
Totally. Even as,
like, this one, I was like, oh, okay, I get how that scam works, but it's like a very simple scam.
It's a very low key one. It basically is how to get a free hotel room at a casino.
Yep.
That's basically the scheme.
Yep.
I love that portion. I almost wish there was a little bit more of that in it because that stuff is so fun. Seeing, like, I wish that this, a part of me wishes that Heartache leaned a little bit more into the con artist side of what they do, you know, because the movie kind of sets
and bolts,
that,
like, yeah, the how nuts it and bolts. Works, you know,
exactly, yeah. Because the movie kind of sets that up and then turns into something kind of different.
Ultimately, it's about characters. Ultimately, I thought that this was a character study of Philip Baker Hall's character primarily, but overall it was really more about the characters and the interactions that it was, like you said, about the scams. You know, some movies really delight in showing you all the details of how, being a professional gambler works and things like that. But this one, aside from that opening scene, it kind of moves on from that aspect of it.
It really is kind of – it's a character piece ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate Anderson kind of working – accepting and working within his limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a debut, I think this thing – understands its limitations. Maybe Anderson understands his own limitations as a writer and as a filmmaker.
Mm.
I think that eventually he would overreach. I don't want to spoil next week's episodes or anything, but I do think that Magnolia represents Anderson at his his least successfully ambitious, I think, in some ways. I think that was him reaching beyond his capacities in some ways. This, to me, feels very much like I understand what I can do at this stage in my career and I'm going to do it.
Yeah. It's very smart, very, very savvy approach to not overextend yourself out of the gate, to leave them wanting more, right?
Yep. I do kind of think it might be the low point of his career, but again, it almost feels churlish to say that because it really is it's his debut.
It's a debut. Yep. You know, a lot of times we talk about a debut being promising. We'll be like, well, this is obviously a first film. You know, that's a phrase you'll use in a review sometimes, but the director shows promise. And,
this is sort of the definition of that.
Yeah.
If I saw this in 1996 or 1997, I would think, oh, that guy might make something really interesting.
Yeah, you'd be like, oh, I'll keep my eye on that guy.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what first features are supposed to do.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did next. It is quite a leap from Heartache to Boogie Nights. I mean, in terms of scope, in terms of style, in terms of ambition.
It makes you wonder if he was consciously holding back in Heartache to leave them wanting more.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe he understood in that point that he did not have the resources or the backing to make something like Boogie Nights until his second feature.
Right, okay.
Boogie Nights, obviously, again, it came out a few months after Heartache. Heartache didn't make a huge splash. It was I don't think it certainly wasn't a hit or anything, but Boogie Nights came out later that year, completely overshadowed it in a lot of respects. Boogie Nights premiered at Toronto that fall, and was also at the New York Film Festival. And it didn't make a ton of money at the box office. It did okay, but it did quite well on the award. Ultimately, did quite well during awards season. Anderson was up for Best Original Screenplay, and the film scored two acting nominations as well for Burt Reynolds and for Julianne Moore.
Yeah, both well deserved. I think their characters in this movie are so fascinating. Yeah. I think Boogie Nights is one of those movies that I wouldn't necessarily call it a cult classic because it did get all of that recognition that you were talking about, but like as someone who was a teenager who was interested in movies in the late 90s, like Boogie Nights was one of those ones that was kind of on your radar, one that you knew you needed to see.
Totally. I mean, I think that it appeals to – I think that Boogie Nights appeals to and this is in no way a slam, but I think it appeals to young cinephiles in the same way that Tarantino's work does.
Oh, yeah.
Or Aronofsky's does.
Yeah.
You know?
Because of what we were talking about, because of the enthusiasm for other movies.
Exactly.
And because there is like a youthful energy to Boogie Nights. Anderson was super young. I think he was 27 when he made this movie.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, you can really kind of see the bravura of a young wunderkind being like, look what I can do in this movie. And of course that's going to appeal to young people because you're also full of piss and vinegar.
Yeah, totally. Well, I remember thinking too, seeing Boogie Nights, it was one of those films that was at a particular point in my life was impressing on me the idea that a filmmaker that there was a personality behind the camera, that whoever made this movie was a person, and they had you know, they had eccentricities and they had idiosyncratic interests.
Yeah, interests and tastes and stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pulp Fiction was probably the first film for me that really where that light bulb went on in my head as a young movie watcher, where I was like, oh, a single person made this movie, which of course a single person didn't make it, but a single
there's
person
a singular
sat behind
vision
the camera.
Behind it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think in both of the movies, the personality comes through like at the screenplay stage. I think that's a big thing of why specifically Tarantino is so celebrated is because his work is really strong at the screenplay stage. And then Anderson, I don't think screenplay first with him necessarily. I think direction. Like he's like a director.
Yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson is.
But of course, there are signatures in his writing as well. You know?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of Boogie Nights as an expression of Anderson as the idea of like, oh, wow, this guy has a vision when so much of it is on some level derivative of other filmmakers. And Scorsese, I think, is the big one in Boogie Nights.
Big one in Boogie Nights, for sure.
I mean, the movie starts like the opening scene of the film, that long tour of the nightclub, is basically the Coca Cabana scene from Goodfellas.
I was going to say, I feel like Boogie Nights is like, hey, do you like that Coca Cabana scene in Goodfellas? We're going to give you a whole movie of that.
Yeah, totally.
There's so many like Steadicam shots through parties in this movie. And it's an interesting choice because what I was struck by watching this again last night is that it's like it's the story of like a scene as told through parties.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. A lot of it really is we're sort of bounding from one party scene to another. And it does have that kind of
and you see the passage of time and the evolution of the relationships and everything through the parties, through what kind of parties they're having and what they're talking about and even what they're wearing.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. I don't feel like it has the same procedural interest as something like Goodfellas. It's not as like we're giving you endless amounts of information about how this world works, but it has that same kind of flow to it.
Yeah. There really isn't very much behind the scenes information about how this world works like at all.
I mean, we get some
very
funny on the set stuff for sure. There is some funny, like some scenes that are some very Ed Wood-ish scenes about making making an adult film sort of, you know, and the sort of the comedy of life on the set.
Right.
There is a little bit of that. But this is not a movie that's like we want to give you all of the ins and outs of the porn industry.
Right. Exactly. Like, for example, the transition into video, you know, like they don't really go into a lot of background about VHS. We just see Burt Reynolds has a meeting with an investor who says, video's the future of adult films. And he says, okay, I'll think about it. And then a few scenes later, you see him walking through a warehouse full of videos.
Yep.
And that's how Anderson conveys that shift in the industry.
Totally. Yeah. No, I actually think that the film is I think the reason is that the film is fundamentally about a larger cultural shift. I think it's about the transition from the 70s to the 80s.
Yeah. And something that's interesting to me is because when you talk about like the party being over and like the end of a decade, a lot of people really talk about that in terms of the 60s. But Boogie Nights is about that from the 70s going into the 80s.
It is. Yeah.
How the excesses of the 70s kind of went sour and got poisoned in the 80s.
Totally. Yeah. It's like this sort of the sort of hedonistic anything goes 70s transitioned into the greed is good 80s.
Yeah.
I actually
more and more cocaine.
I actually think that the film is rewatching it. I was struck by the feeling that the film is really about 70s New Hollywood. That it's using the porn industry as a proxy for the way that the mainstream film industry changed.
Interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you have all these, you know, all of them, there's a kind of touching idealism to the pornographers we meet in this film, you know? I mean, Burt Reynolds.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Burt Reynolds he's kind of loosely based on a guy called Bob Chin, who's a real life figure. At least Bob Chin claimed that Burt Reynolds and Boogie Nights was based on him.
And nobody disputed it.
Yeah, I think there was some sort of background, too, where like Anderson had talked to him or something.
Got
like
it. Yeah. Reynolds' character, Jack Horner, has sort of ambitions to make art in the field of pornography. There's this great scene where they're sitting at a diner, another diner scene, actually, where they're sitting at the diner and he's talking about how his dream is to make a film where after the audience jacks off, they just sit there and finish watching the movie. Yeah. Because they're so involved
they
in
need
it,
to know how it ends.
Yeah. So I mean, I do think there's a little bit of like the characterization of Ed Wood in Tim Burton's biopic about Ed Wood in the Jack Horner character, somebody who has an enormous amount of ambition despite the fact that he's working in a kind of a tawdry medium.
Yeah, and another thing about it, and you see this even more in Julianne Moore's character, Amber Waves, who if Jack Horner is the patriarch, she's the matriarch.
Yeah.
And it is a family, and they are very hedonistic, and, you know, they're all having sex with each other, and, you know, Amber, she stars in these movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there are some vague references, you know, to her, she has a custody battle where she can't see her son, and they make some references to her being arrested and kind of the seedy side of the whole thing. But Jack and Amber really are kind of a wholesome mom and dad.
They are.
They're especially Amber. She's like the mother figure. You know, when someone's upset, they go and they lay in her lap and they cry. You know, she's an interesting, really interesting, almost a Mary Magdalene type of character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're making smut, but they are a family. And I actually think it's one of the movie's better—
And they take care of each other.
They do. I actually think it's one of the movie's better jokes is that there is an innocence to these characters.
They're wholesome.
They are ultimately rather wholesome in a lot of ways, despite what they do for a living.
Despite being very, very sexually free.
Yep. And I think a lot of them kind of have a childlike mindset in some ways, too.
Well, you know? Especially Dirk Diggler.
Right.
You know, he's kind of the—I was also struck with this. I was like, oh, it's the original himbo.
Yeah.
The himbo character has risen in popularity these past, you know, decade or so. But Mark Wahlberg was definitely doing the himbo back in 97.
I mean, perfect casting. You know? I mean, it's, you know, Wahlberg in the years since has said that he regrets making the movie because he feels that it's, I don't know, some shit like it's he has moral objections to the film now.
Hush.
Which is funny because
but
this is
so
such
wholesome.
A nice and wholesome movie in a lot of ways. But beyond that, like Anderson, I mean, for one thing, Wahlberg has a movie career in part because of Boogie Nights.
Mm-hmm.
Like Boogie Nights made him a movie star, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, Anderson saw something in him that maybe not even the most flattering qualities in Wahlberg. He was like, you can play a confident dummy.
Yeah.
You know, you can play this big kid, which is really what Dirk Diggler is. He's this kid who never gives up on the idea of being a star.
Right. And it does take a darker turn, but like at least the first half of this movie, this is a long movie, it's 2.5 hours long, but at least his rise to fame, it kind of has a sort of almost like a Candide quality to it of like a classic story of like an idiot kind of like stumbling through life, you know, having adventures.
Yeah. I mean, Wahlberg in the years since, you know, I feel like Wahlberg, some of the best work Wahlberg's done has been in comedies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he I think he does have a strong comedic instinct, although I sometimes wonder if filmmakers just understand that there's something intrinsically funny about him.
Yeah, that he's just deep down kind of a ridiculous person.
Because right? He is. Let's be clear. Mark Wahlberg is a ridiculous person.
Okay, here's something that I was curious to get your opinion on. When I was watching the film, yeah, you have this like ridiculous character, and it is a comedy, you know, mm-hmm. through most of it. It really, mm-hmm. you know, is primarily a comedy, I think. But like, I thought, I was like, so are these jokey characters being taken seriously, or are they just like jokey characters inserted into a more serious context? Or what do you think is the relationship there in the movie? Because, you know, like it is comedic, but like we were saying, there's also the affection for the characters. And I don't think it's like knowing that Dirk is ridiculous and Mark Wahlberg is ridiculous, I don't feel like the movie's making fun of him per se.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie has a sincere affection for almost all of its characters. Mm. There's really not a bad guy in this movie.
Not you know? Cocaine. Cocaine is
cocaine's
definitely the villain.
The bad guy.
It's the villain of Boogie Nights. It ruins everything.
I don't even really think of the Alfred Molina character who shows up in that great late set piece in the film. I don't even really feel like Molina is a villain.
No. Again, he's just too high.
He's too high.
He's been too high for too long.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that Anderson recognizes a lot of these people as ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I think that he sees that a lot of them are kind of dim, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, it's not just Wahlberg. I mean, John C. Reilly's character is not the brightest bulb either.
Yeah. You know? And they've all gotten very lucky to be able to make a life out of their natural talents.
Yeah. Although he has that amazing moment, too, during that documentary within the film where Julianne Moore's character, Amber Waves, makes that tribute to Wahlberg's character, that documentary tribute, which allows us to kind of see how big his head has gotten over the years. Mm-hmm. But there's this great moment where they cut to John C. Reilly's character, and you can see him through talking realize as he's talking that he's not going to get to do this forever.
Yeah.
Like we basically get to follow his train of thought as he realizes that his opportunity as a porn actor
it'll
will
end
dry
eventually.
Up.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I have to find something else to do, I guess.
And you do have the character, you know, you have Don Cheadle's character. Mm-hmm. He, you know, you want to talk about wholesome and the family through line.
Yeah.
Like we follow him trying to get out of the business over the course of it. And I think in some ways, like that subplot that's a really integral part of the film, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I think what it comes down to is that Anderson is not above exposing their foibles. I think he mm-hmm. has a lot of fun with these characters. But he also has a deep affection for them. And I think by the end, I think what we're watching is a story in some respects about survivors,
mm-hmm.
people who survived a very tumultuous decade in American life
mm-hmm.
and people who came out the other side.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There is a real – there's a sweetness and a sort of redemptive arc.
There really is. Well, especially like I was saying, Machito's character, like he wants to branch off and he wants to open a stereo store, but he can't get a loan because him and his wife worked in porn.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say, in case you haven't seen Boogie Nights, how it happens, but the movie's definitely rooting for him. And it is a very dark joke how he ends up making it work, but he ends up making it work.
Yep.
That part right there, like that scene that I'm alluding to, but mm-hmm. not saying what happened, that's one of the most Tarantino-esque moments in this film.
It is. I do think there's some real...
Because it's a sick, violent joke.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there is some of that in this. But I remember even when I first saw this, I had seen Pulp Fiction at that point. And I remember seeing some affinity between the two of them.
Mm.
Obviously, in the years since, I think that they've diverged a lot.
Yeah.
I would never confuse a recent Anderson movie for a recent Tarantino movie.
No, not really, except that there's a lot of scenes of Dirk Diggler talking to talking to the mirror in Boogie Nights. And I was like, oh, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has Leonardo DiCaprio talking to the
good
mirror.
Point. Yep. Well, that scene obviously is another, at least the final scene of the film is another Scorsese lift, one might say.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the end of...
homage.
Yeah, there we go. It's basically the end of Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you can see, I would say that Anderson is one of the few filmmakers who might be Tarantino's equal in terms of the use of a needle drop.
Mm-hmm. The soundtrack in this movie
I'm often annoyed by wall-to-wall soundtracks. I sometimes think that there's a certain laziness to just papering your entire movie with pop cuts. Ooh, you know?
I could name some names right now, but I won't.
Yeah. there are some, you know, I feel like it takes a certain finesse and a certain artistry to be able to do that well. And Anderson does it really well.
Well,
in this.
It's about restraint and knowing when the right time is. And sure. Like you said, not just wallpapering it top to bottom. Cool. With
not just, not always just counting on the music to do all the work for you.
Right.
You know, I mean, you mentioned that this thing plays a lot of the time like this sort of extended bacchanal, you know, and it needs a soundtrack for that. You know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
The music is constantly situating us in the moment.
And the music along with the like I said, the changing fashions and the changing decor in the different houses that people live in, that is chronicling the shift from the 70s to the 80s.
Yep.
That's done mostly through production design and soundtrack and costumes.
Totally. Yeah, there's just some really choice moments with how he uses the music. I mean, I think for me the one that works the best in the film is when he cues up "Hot Chocolates, You Sexy Thing."
Yeah.
When Philip Seymour Hoffman's character first catches a glimpse of Dirk.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
we get that
Philip
little
Seymour
iris.
Hoffman in this one.
Man.
Oh,
it's so heartbreaking. This movie has so many grace notes, and one of them I think is the scene where Hoffman's Scotty comes on to Dirk.
Yeah, he finally kisses Dirk. He's been obsessed with Dirk for years. Yeah.
And Dirk is actually pretty nice about it, honestly.
Yeah,
he's actually just like, dude, what are you doing?
Well,
come
kissing
on,
your friends
inside.
Is not an unusual thing to do in this in this world. So.
Right, exactly. He's just sort of like, dude, don't.
He's just like, hey. Appreciate it, but no thank you.
I love you too, buddy. He even says that.
Yeah,
you know?
He says that. I love you too, buddy. And he gives him a pat on the back. Like, love you too, but it's not like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But that, we get that shot of Hoffman just sitting in the car crying, saying, "I'm an idiot." It's fucking heartbreaking. And
it's
there's just so many small moments. Small touching moments in this film between, as the movie is, because the movie is sort of constantly coursing forward. It's like we're covering over a decade of time here. We're in sort of montage mode. But Anderson always finds time to stop and find these tender moments.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that really gets me is when Heather Graham's Roller Girl asks if she can call Julianne Moore's character mom.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's like, "I wish you were my mother.
I wish you were my mother." And she's like, "Oh, me too, sweetie." Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I think the kind of the debauchery of the whole thing is so implied that Anderson doesn't have to show that much of it. You know, like the sex isn't that explicit.
No.
You know, it's R-rated, but it's not, you know, it doesn't push it that far. And all that is just sort of in the background. So he foregrounds the sweetness to kind of balance out the flavor, to use a describe it in food terms.
Yeah.
Sweet and salty.
Yeah. No, it's interesting that Anderson was sort of fighting for a while that he was like, the movie needs to be 3 hours long and it needs to be NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
It's neither of those things.
Yeah.
He supposedly gave up the NC-17 in exchange for the 3 hours.
I see.
And then ended up
cutting
a half hour anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that watching the film, it's interesting to think that this might have at some point have been an NC-17 because, again, yes, so much of the way that he films even the sex scenes in it is mostly through implication. I mean, we don't, you know, we're not seeing.
It's assumed.
Right.
Yeah.
We're really not seeing that much sex in this movie, you know.
This is what you call themes.
Yeah.
You know, when they rate something R for themes.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, this is one of those.
Yeah. As a set piece machine, too, it's just gangbusters. That's another way I think. Like the Sister Christian scene towards the end of the film with Alfred Molina, I think is like.
With the kids throwing the
fire. Oh, my God. That's such a nerve-wracking device. There's just this
reckless
guy walking around throwing like firecrackers.
Yeah, it looks like a teenage boy, very young-looking man walking around wearing a Rick Springfield T-shirt, I think he is, just throwing fireworks.
Yep.
And again, you know, showing, not telling, it says so much about, you know, the depravity and the recklessness of this guy's lifestyle, that he has a teenage boy who you're like, are you having sex with that boy? Just like throwing fireworks everywhere.
Yeah. That scene is so so tense and so funny at once. I mean, it really is like I look at that and I think that is the best
Tarantino set piece that Tarantino never directed himself, you know?
Yeah. I think that actually Anderson is better than Tarantino about, like, riding the wave and the shift between tones, mm-hmm. you know? Like, it's more natural and it flows better.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I look at this and a part of me wonders if Anderson – I don't think Anderson will ever make a movie quite like this again. Mm-hmm. I think he's kind of moved out of this period. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think of Anderson's work not just because you know, he works so much with Johnny Greenwood now.
Right.
But I sort of think of him a little bit like Radiohead, which is that he was one kind of artist and he was really good at that. And then he decided he wanted to be something more. He wanted to be a stranger and more idiosyncratic artist. So I look at the sort of the you could even say the parallel arcs of his career and Radiohead's career. Mm-hmm. And I sort of look at something like Boogie Nights like his The Bends.
It's totally. Like,
you know?
I dig that, yeah.
Like his – it's such a good version of this style.
Right.
That was particularly popular, particularly this – time in movie making that he just ultimately moved beyond. And I don't begrudge him moving beyond it. And I think that the work he's made since is really interesting. And I think he's made better movies than Boogie Nights.
Some people are content to play the hits every night and some people need more.
Exactly. Yep. but I do sometimes mourn that we probably won't get an Anderson movie quite like this again because it's such a – it's just such an ecstatic good time.
Yeah. And – I mean, just like there's so much that's remarkable about it. You know, all those moments we were talking about, the casting is incredible. There's so many like great little side characters in this film and they're all realized so well. But another thing is just like the detail of it. Just like I always really admire when I like David Fincher because I admire directors who are very detail oriented. And I think the Boogie Nights, you know, for all of its kind of like wild, Bachnall and show off camera work and stuff is also a very detail oriented film. It's very well thought through. Like for there's sure. no shots are thrown away. Like right. even, you know, there's a scene where Don Cheadle's buying donuts and he comes up with like a shot of where he's filming from behind the donut case, mm-hmm. you know, kind of going from left to right, watching him pick out donuts. Like even a little, no moment is wasted.
Yeah, totally agree. I would say too that for this is a showboaty film in some ways. It's definitely Anderson is like, I have something to prove.
But if you're good at it, why not?
And beyond that, I think that it has – I think it's a deeper piece of work than a lot of his contemporaries who were working in this kind of mode. I think it's a deeper piece of work than that.
Yeah. That it being deeper and having more to it than that. I think, you know, we were talking about the 70s, the 80s and the end of the party. And I think it's interesting that it's set in the San Fernando Valley and Anderson's from the San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. And it almost kind of plays like a loss of innocence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even though there's nothing innocent about the porn industry, there's still like a loss of innocence as they move into the 80s.
Yeah. And then a rebirth eventually, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, talking about them as a film about survivors, people mm-hmm. who went through that. Because it's almost like a dark decade of the soul. You know, you talk about dark night of the soul. It's like there's this whole portion of the movie that's just like their lot. Like, I do think this is easily Anderson's funniest movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it mostly is a comedy.
Mostly.
During that period, not so much.
Yeah, no, you know? No. Yeah, it gets down to towards the end, there's like a montage of two different fights that are happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And that scene is really just a gut punch, which, you know, I was talking about his ability to kind of transition between tones. Mm-hmm. And I think that going from the comedy to that so smoothly really shows a lot of talent.
Yeah. You know what I thought of actually during that scene that you're talking about? And it's the scene where you're sort of the movie is paralleling. It's cross-cutting between sort of Dirk's rock bottom. Sort of return to his pre-fame days where mm-hmm. he's if we're talking about the same scene.
Where
here.
We are. Yeah.
Yeah. So Dirk is sort of brought to rock bottom, sort of doing something that he's not done since he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Roller Girl sort of her past catches up with her as well during mm-hmm. a really degrading scene involving Jack trying to sort of sort of chase trends in terms of what's big in the porn industry at the time, mm-hmm. amateurs. The two scenes probably count as the most harrowing moments in the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely both their rock bottoms.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the movie is cross-cutting between them, and I actually thought a little bit of the extended climax of Requiem for a Dream.
Interesting.
You know, and the way that sort of cuts around between various – you know, it kind of has that same tone almost, you mm-hmm, know. Mm-hmm. Aronofsky obviously came up around the same time as Anderson did, and Requiem came out a few years later. But I think there's some kinship there as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, talking about Anderson, these early phases of his career, you see him as part of his generation mm-hmm. a lot. You know, all these other filmmakers of that generation keep coming up in the conversation. And I think all of them are, you know, in this movie.
Yeah. So Boogie Nights was the film that pretty much made Anderson, I think, mm-hmm. and made his career. And
I love this movie. I watched it again and I was like, 5 stars. I hardly ever give out 5 stars. I loved it. I'm
a big fan as well.
Yeah.
I do think it's kind of – it ultimately ends up looking like something of an outlier in his career. I think mm-hmm. that his movies got – changed from here, and as they should, you know, when you're a filmmaker, you should always be growing, I think. But I cherish this moment in his career.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, yeah, just like aesthetically, and it's interesting to me too, thinking about how movies like this in this period in filmmaking shaped my taste too,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we were at an age where watching these movies was formative to us.
Oh yeah. No, big time. I mean, this movie is sort of a seminal movie of my development as a cinephile.
Yeah.
Just
mine
from
too.
When it arrived.
And just like stuff that I like right. bravura camera work. And I was watching it last night being like, I wonder how much Boogie Nights kind of
yeah.
turned me on to that style, you know, because I was watching Scorsese too around that time, but mm-hmm. Yeah, not. I wonder. I wonder how much these early films really shaped my taste.
I think it probably also clarified the degree to which all of these filmmakers are on some, at least some spiritual level, connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was possible to be a teenager and to be getting into Boogie Nights and also be getting in pretty much simultaneously getting into Scorsese.
Yeah.
And seeing those links and that sort of. You know, turning on a light bulb in your head.
Yeah.
Oh, all of these people are sort of...
Are connected. Yeah, yeah. It is very much like we were saying up top. There's a certain type of director who is a pure cinephile director, and Anderson's definitely one of those. That's all we've got for you this week. You can watch Hard 8 on Amazon Prime Video, and Boogie Nights is available as a digital rental. And while you're online, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Film Club wherever you get your podcasts.
This week's episode of Film Club was hosted by me, Alex Dowd, and by Katie Reif. It was edited and mixed by Zach Goldsboro, and our motion graphics designer is Julie Mullins. Stay tuned next week where we continue our series on Paul Thomas Anderson. We'll be talking about Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love. Thanks, folks.
Bye.